Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we're offering a free sample PDF of the May-June issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. If you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550, White Plains, Maryland 20695. Welcome back to the Barnes Review History Hour, your home for fearless historical inquiry. This is your host, Jose Nino. This evening, I'm joined by German chemist Germar Rudolph. How are you this evening, Germar?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And yourself?
Oh, I'm doing great. And I'm really looking forward to this discussion because I have become acquainted with your work through some of the interviews I've seen you featured in at Red Ice TV, and I find your background to be quite interesting given the length of time you've spent researching very sensitive topics such as the Holocaust and some of the legal issues you face. But just give the audience, for those who are not familiar, just a brief rundown of the work you've done over the last few decades.
Yeah. I am born in Germany, raised and schooled in Germany, did a master's thesis in chemistry, and then went for a PhD in natural sciences in general. So it was an interdisciplinary field that was done at the Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in Stuttgart. Now, during that time, I happened to stumble over the so-called Leuchter Report. That is an expert report written by an American specialist for execution technologies by the name of Fred Leuchter, who was asked by the defense team of German-Canadian immigrant Ernst Sildor back in 88 for the second time on trial in Canada for contesting the Orthodox Holocaust narrative to go to Auschwitz and Majdanek camps in Poland and to figure out whether from his point of view as an expert in execution technology, the claimed homicidal gas chambers there could have operated and did actually operate as is generally claimed, since Fred Leuchter has been designing, maintaining, and updating homicidal gas chambers in the United States, in several states where capital punishment was conducted, among other things, by using the same kind of poison gas in homicidal gas chambers as a set of been used at Auschwitz and to some degree at Majdanek camps. So he came back and had, based on a number of reasons, came to the conclusion, no, it can't have happened. It caused a ruckus, and I learned about it around that time. And as a chemist, I got interested in it. I had a private interest in history. There is this intersection between history and chemistry when it comes to poison gas used to kill people. It's of course a chemical issue, and the question whether or not that poison gas leaves any long-term stable detectable traces in the masonry of those chambers. Now, eventually, after I had written a letter to the editor of a newspaper where I pointed out that this Leuchter report didn't quite convince me because there were a lot of questions that were left open or not even addressed or brought up that need to be settled before one can come to any definitive conclusions on the matter. I was contacted by a defense team in Germany asking me to actually do that kind of research that would cover all the bases that I had found uncovered. And I found that very intriguing. During my PhD studies, I was living in the ivory towers of science at the Max Planck Institute and a little bit detached from any reality. And that research I was doing privately for a law firm, Interest Law, was actually intriguing, exciting, relevant, had political, societal, historical impacts all over the place, no matter which way the cat jumps. And therefore, I was doing it gladly, just expenses covered, nothing paid, because I was just very curious to find out for myself what the issue is here. So I ended up writing that expert report after a year or so of research. Was introduced in 7 or 8 court cases in Germany where defendants had been accused of contesting the mainstream narrative, which is a punishable up to 5 years in prison in Germany. And that led to a little bit of a upheaval among the German judiciary, because technically speaking, or legally speaking, I should say, they could not turn me down. An expert witness already present in the courtroom, his testimony relevant for the case cannot be rejected. But they did it anyway. They violated the law, and some judges were panicking because they knew they themselves make themselves criminal liable when they break the law. Case may come back to bite them on several levels. They were getting their behinds covered by the German Supreme Court that changed case law, saying, yeah, we've always done that. We reject evidence in that way, even though it's in violation of law. In that case, it's a special case. We have to do it. And then they changed case law later even more, trying to stop me by saying that filing a motion to introduce evidence that contests the mainstream narrative on the Holocaust is actually a crime. So try and defend yourself if you're a defendant in such a case, or even if you're an expert that comes up with a testimony that is not aligned with what the government wants to hear. If you do that, you commit a crime in the courtroom. So defense is illegal in Germany. It's not just impossible, it's illegal. It's another crime. Great. So instead of resolving the issue legally, which was the initial attempt with this expert report, the whole legal situation in Germany became catastrophic for revisionists, for Holocaust skeptics. Now, I had only covered the one tiny question of whether or not there is chemical residue to be found in the masonry of the buildings claimed to have been homicidal gas chambers. That addresses only one issue of the Auschwitz camp, which is a massive camp where a lot of things happen. The Auschwitz camp is only one camp, but many camps during the wartime Germany, all their occupied areas where a lot of things are said to have happened. And camps themselves, again, are only one set of locations where things are said to have happened in context with the Holocaust. So we're talking about a tiny subsection. And I knew, even if I can answer the question of homicidal gassings in Auschwitz, yes or no, to some definite satisfaction, it's not addressing the bigger picture, all the other issues. So I got very curious to address the other issues too, all the other camps, all the other murder methods, demographic problems, legal problems, what is with all the trials, what's with all the witnesses. And I assembled an international team of skeptic researchers sitting down, assembling a collection of papers to bring all these issues together at a level of the state of the art of knowledge as we had it back in the early 1990s. And that book was published in 1994 in the German language. By that time, the German judiciary was going after me like the devil goes after the poor soul, trying to stop me, putting me on trial eventually for my research, sentencing me to 14 months with basically telling me I can't introduce any evidence showing that my research is correct. The 14 months then allowed them to apply a 1939 law enacted by Adolf Hitler, saying you can deny or withdraw academic degrees from people who use their academic credentials to commit crimes. So I had used my chemical credentials to commit the crime of, quote unquote, denying what has supposedly happened at Auschwitz. Therefore, they denied me my PhD title. denied me to go through my final exam. I had highest merits from my supervisors and the others saying, well, I'm an A-plus student and that should all go down, but the university threatened they're going to apply that law. So that was the end of my career. But by that time, I had been involved in these other publishing activities. And I was publishing a book, the 1994 anthology that I just mentioned, putting the state of the art together by many people on many topics, eventually got actually published in the English language as well. It is volume number one of the Holocaust Handbook series that I started in the English language in 1999. And if people are interested in it, it's all accessible free of charge as PDF files on the website holocausthandbooks.com. Volume one, my chemical expert report, updated, expanded, and so forth, is volume two. Back in 93, 94, 95, I was working on new projects. One of them, a refutation of a French historian's take on Auschwitz, is volume number 14. Anyway, every time I was either publishing a book, publishing a paper in any kind of periodical in Germany, police would show up, both at my home confiscating everything and at the publisher, the periodical outlet, wherever they found anything written, published by me, they hit hard trying to stamp out everything. So I had one criminal case after the other piling up, and at the end there were five cases pending in addition to my case. Originally I was sentenced for, and I decided I can't take it anymore. I'm leaving. I left for England, lived in exile in England for a number of years with my family, and turned that hobby of mine into a business, into my career. Started a small publishing company called Cassidy Publishers that was doing nothing else but researching and publishing research results of Holocaust studies, forensic and archival studies that could no longer be published in an increasing number of European governments, which starting in the 1990s, one after the other, introduced quote-unquote Holocaust denial laws. And if you look at the landscape of Europe nowadays, you have far fewer countries where this Holocaust skepticism is still legal than there are which have outlawed it. So eventually I left England, came to the United States because England, the media started a witch hunt against me, came to the United States, expanded into the English language realm and started turning everything into English. To cut the story a little short, 35 years of forensic research, of archival research, of publishing activity has led to by now 53 volumes of the Holocaust Handbook series being published and accessible all online, covering pretty much every base of the Holocaust narrative, unparalleled in their scale and scope, in their depth. Mainstream cannot get in anywhere close to the intensity and the thoroughness that our studies have at researching all these things. So much information in it that is really difficult to wrap one's head around, even for me. I've published them both in the English and the German language. I've reissued many new editions, gone over these books over and over again, yet still I could sometimes not find a reference that I was looking for. I knew something is proved with some source somewhere in these books, and where is it? I had to search. So eventually it came to the point where this overkill of information had to be organized in some way to make it accessible for the general public, for even for experts, for anyone. And the idea was born in 2021 to create a Holocaust encyclopedia that makes all these things in summary accessible by keywords with references to further reading where the details can be found. I sat down in 2023 to write this encyclopedia, and it was released online in September 23 and in print edition for the first print edition then in late 1923. We're now in the fifth edition with it. It's a bestseller by any means. We've sold now over 2,000 copies. You know, encyclopedias, specialty encyclopedias usually are bought only by specialists in a field and by libraries. Libraries don't buy our books because it's politically incorrect. They won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. But we managed to sell this book to the general public, to anyone who is curious about quote-unquote forbidden knowledge that governments, mainstream media, mainstream scholars like to bury. And I've heard from many people that they read this encyclopedia cover to cover because it's such an exciting read. Now, I myself have advantage of it. You can go online, holocaustencyclopedia.com. All of it is online and accessible free of charge, plus with audio in case you don't want to read entries, you can listen to them. We keep it up to date. As I mentioned, the fourth edition by now, we keep getting updates and expansions. And it has allowed me to get a real grasp of the entire field of Holocaust studies, which is huge. We're talking about an event covering 3 to 4 years. We're talking about the core of the extermination camps, an entire continent, and thousands of locations. So, and of course, many, many witnesses. All this is covered in there to one degree or another. And it has helped me to connect dots to get an idea of who's done it. When it comes to the Holocaust, things have been exaggerated, distorted, twisted. They were spin doctors. As the saying goes, the truth is the first victim of every war. And there's no different in this case for the Second World War. And the question is, who has done the exaggeration, the inventions here? And when I was putting that together, I could connect the dots. I saw the red thread running through the narrative and could point to who's done it, actually. And I've summarized it in a book that I released later last year. It's called Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story, where I show how during the war this narrative has developed for the various camps that are claimed to have been centers of extermination, who was behind it, and how it was eventually streamlined into a consistent narrative, because it started out as complete anecdotal chaos and anarchy. Everyone was claiming anything they damn well pleased. But today we have a mainstream narrative that is very, or looks superficially consistent, and but that's not how it started. So who has done the streamlining? It's answered in there. Another thing that I came across when I had one of the shows, actually not with the Red Dice, as you mentioned, but with Jake Shields, was not a historian by any stretch of the imagination, but he has a YouTube followership and also on Twitter. This is quite considerable. And he goes into controversies and conspiracies and what have you. He had me on his show late last year with a mainstream historian who agreed to debate me, Dr. Van. In that discussion, Dr. Van mentioned that, to quote him accurately, that he thinks that the Nuremberg trial provides all sorts of useful evidence for the Holocaust. And I wanted to respond to that, starting showing that a lot of evidence introduced during the International Military Tribunal is phony and rejected today even by the mainstream, which shows that the evidentiary record of the Nuremberg trial is anything but reliable, to put it mildly. But the 2-hour podcast with a question and answer format is not the right way of making a good point out or showing that the Nuremberg trial is actually the opposite of a trial where the Holocaust has been proven. All it proved basically is it was a sham trial with a lot of phony evidence introduced. I said, well, I would like to actually quote just a book that we have for revisionists showing that the Holocaust was not proven at Nuremberg, that it was a complete sham trial. There's an older book by Carlos Porter, Belgian American revisionist Carlos Porter, The Holocaust Made in Russia, where he goes a little bit into the Nuremberg trials, unreliable evidence. But after having written the encyclopedia, I had in the encyclopedia all the evidence quoted in various entries that were introduced during the IMT and why it is unreliable. And I could now go in there, plug all these places in the encyclopedia that mention the Nuremberg trial put together and enrich it with stuff that's not mentioned and put it into a consistent story. And that's a book I released just a short while ago. It's called The Holocaust Proven at Nuremberg, revealing the evidence presented at the International Military Tribunal. Because that tribunal looms large over Holocaust studies as the place all the Nuremberg trials, actually, as the trials that proved irrefutable that the Nazis committed this systematic mass murder during the war against the Jews. And you have to, as a Holocaust skeptic, you have to address that, because trials in general, court sentences are considered by the public as reliable as the ultimate proof of someone's guilt of some crime having been committed. Particularly the one in Nuremberg has had a very high reputation by the general public, by the published opinion in mass media. So spin-offs from the encyclopedia, the knowledge I've gained myself after 35 years of being immersed in that field, of being at the forefront of publishing pretty much everything that was produced over the 35 years I've put out. We have the periodical Inconvenient History that puts out new stuff. And some of the articles, actually, you may find both in Barnes Review and Inconvenient History. So there's some intersection between the two. And use that wealth of knowledge I've gathered to write the encyclopedia, and now use that overlook, that insight I have of commanding more or less the entire field, of coming up with some books that give introductions and or answers to cool questions that so far haven't been answered satisfactorily. Now, it has led, of course, to a little bit more upheaval that I did not, in my private life, that I didn't mention. 2005, I was here in the United States. I have been for 5 years. I had applied for political asylum, and eventually the United States deported me. After I had married a U.S. citizen, the marriage was recognized. I was allowed to get a green card, and then I was suddenly deported in violation of U.S. law. That was later confirmed. I won the case. I had to litigate against the U.S. government to let me back home to my wife and my daughter. But it took 6 years and $250,000 to get there. In the meantime, I was deported to Germany. They put me on trial there again for books I had published while here in the United States, some of the Holocaust handbooks, particularly Volume 15, Lectures on the Holocaust, where I summarize the research in a dialogue format. That's Volume 15. And it is the starting point of the encyclopedia, actually, because it has a little bit of an encyclopedic scope. It has a subject index, and I use that subject index as a starting point to define entries for the encyclopedia. I was sentenced for that book to another, and for a promotion brochure, for another 30 months imprisonment. And in that trial, defense is illegal. My lawyers were muzzled. They were not allowed to speak a word. And any documents we introduced were not allowed to be read out in court. Everyone had to read them at home. So it was a complete quiet, silent proceeding with no one being allowed on the defense side of saying anything, proving anything. It was a charade. But I got out of it after having served my time, litigated against the U.S. government, who didn't want to let me come back home, won that case, and I'm in the country, have been since 2011. And have kept going along that line. By the time I was deported in 2020, we had 20 volumes of the Holocaust handbook series out, roughly. Now we're on 53. I'm working on 54 because we have the encyclopedia. And I just launched HolocaustAcademy.com to put critical thinking into Holocaust education. That's an online platform that we developed to enable people to learn about these things without things and in a way that you can't find anywhere else.
With respect to the typical narrative you hear about the Auschwitz gas chambers, what does that narrative consist of, and what has your research proven to like demonstrate that this narrative is completely off base?
Well, my research was only concerned with the question whether or not Zyklon B has been used in certain buildings. But the narrative has many more aspects that I did not address in that particular study. But of course, in the 53 volumes of Holocaust Handbook series, there are many more studies, most of them written by Italian scholar Carlo Martonio, based on archival research of material that was made accessible after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, if I were to summarize my own research, the central issue is, does Zyklon B, a name that probably rings a bell for most listeners, leave any chemical traces in masonry that could be detected after decades of exposure to the environment? Zyklon B is a trade name which exists again today. They for a number of decades, renamed it after the U.S. miniseries Holocaust in 1978. It got such a bad rap, that product, that the company renamed it. But now they've put it back up because it's just selling better if you call it Zyklon B. It's an insecticide based on hydrogen cyanide. And hydrogen cyanide does react with rust to form a very stable blue pigment by the name umbrella term iron blue. It comes with different trivial names, Prussian blue, Berlin blue, Thornbird's blue, and a number of names that it has. But basically, it's all one group of chemicals. They are blue, sometimes turquoise blue, greenish blue, and they are very stable. And they can withstand environmental exposure, depending a little bit on the circumstances. But the circumstances we're talking about here is that in masonry, they can last a similar time span as the masonry itself lasts. Now, if you don't take care of masonry, mortar gets washed out, bricks deteriorate, and a house not take care of kind of crumbles and disappears within 100 years. And that's also a time span that this chemical kind of disintegrates. So the walls there, your chemical should be there. And then it's a matter of taking samples, having them analyzed, and see whether they are there. Another question that you have to address is, could it have formed in the first place? Zyklon B is an insecticide. The intended use, and you can show by archival resources, the actual use that is proven by documents was to kill primarily lice with it. Lice, fleas, any kind of vermin that is a problem in the concentration camp. It's primarily lice and fleas, bed bugs, what have you. And there were in Auschwitz several buildings that were specifically designed and used as fumigation chambers, as disinfestation chambers. So clothes, bed, linen, mattresses, and so forth that were infested with bed bugs, fleas, lice. They were put in those disinfestation chambers and exposed to hydrogen cyanide, to Zyklon B. The walls of these buildings have high amounts of this just mentioned iron blue pigment. You can see it optically because they're patchy blue, the walls, not just on the surface. Inside the mortar, they are kind of saturated. Normally, in the expert literature, they say if you use that in a disinfestation chamber, you should seal the walls with a impenetrable paint, some shellac paint or something, so that the walls don't soak up the hydrogen cyanide. That's a loss you want to avoid, and it is a health hazard because later the hydrogen cyanide will slowly keep evaporating from the masonry, and that's a health problem. So seal them. But these walls in Auschwitz were not sealed. They were makeshift, relatively primitively done, not well engineered, so they were soaked through with hydrogen cyanide and they're patchy blue all over the place. And you can detect those hydrogen cyanide traces in the form of iron blue everywhere. Now, it's different with the locations where people are said to have been executed. The fact of the matter is that you do not find any reproducible cyanide traces in them at all. Now, I say reproducible. If anyone looks up the voice report of mine, you'll find that the traces, the samples taken and what is set up in homicidal gas chambers actually have minute traces. But with new research, it has turned out that these are not reproducible and that they are probably fake results caused by high contents of lime. Of mortar, lime in mortar and concrete, which is the main stuff that is actually in mortar and plaster. And it gives you a background reading of in your method that looks like cyanide, but it isn't. You have to correct it for it. But the methods used by the analytical institutes, they don't expect high carbonate content, and therefore they haven't corrected for it. So in one case, I had another set of analysis done by an institute that actually did the correction after I informed them what the problem is. And lo and behold, zero. So no cyanide traces in the homicidal gas chambers. Now, there could be two explanations for that. I, there were no homicidal gassings, or B, these things couldn't have formed, because homicidal gassings are different than disinfestations, because humans are more susceptible to and more sensitive to hydrogen cyanide than insects. So particularly when we're talking insects, you have to also kill the eggs and the larvae. In particular, eggs are, they have a very slow metabolism. They don't die easily. You have to expose them to higher concentrations and longer time. Then you have to do it with humans. So that could be one reason. Another reason could be the homicidal gas chambers were built differently. The construction material was different and the procedure was different. So we need to take into consideration a lot of factors that can play into how much we would expect to find before it makes sense to look. Now, I've done that, and the result is that the one gas chamber, claimed gas chamber at Auschwitz, is said to have been used most frequently of them all. There were said to have been seven of these facilities actually in the cap, but not all of them have been used on the same frequency, or so it's claimed. Actually, one of them only very rarely, if at all. There's some even among the mainstream saying it wasn't used at all. And then there are two that were used on and off a little bit, but they don't exist anymore. You couldn't take samples there. Another two to some degree, but maybe not. So because they were not equipped with a ventilation system, couldn't have really worked. They have been completely dismantled, blown up, and they don't exist. So we can't take samples there either. But then there are two facilities that are used, said to have been used intensely, consistently, and constantly for 1.5 years. And one of them is in relatively good shape in terms of the walls are still standing. The roof, even though it is caved in after it was blown up, is still partly protecting the walls. And it makes sense to take samples there. We know, because they're still there, we know what material they are, how they were constructed, what the conditions were. We know from the physical remains, as well as the documentation, that these were unheated, moist, cold underground rooms, whereas the disinfestation chambers, where you find large amounts, are above ground, heated, dry rooms that were made of very cheap plaster and mortar, whereas the underground basements, the alleged homicidal gas chambers, were built into the groundwater. They had to be built with heavy concrete, with mortar and plaster, very rigid cement to withstand the moisture and the humidity. And there's a completely different chemistry we're looking here between those fumigation chambers, warm, dry, above ground, and the plain homicidal gas chambers, underground, moist. And fact of the matter is that when you're moist, when you're cool, when you're highly alkaline with a lot of cement in it, as in the homicidal gas chambers, the tendency of absorbing hydrogen cyanide and turning it into this blue pigment is way higher than in dry, warm, cheap plaster buildings above ground. So that kind of offsets the fact that homicidal gassings are shorter and potentially a lower concentration, even though that needs to be argued, because the claim is that homicidal gassings happened fast. In order to make them happen fast, you have to have high concentration. So low concentration is out of the picture if we take the having this count serious. Concentration is similar in both cases, but time exposure is still an issue. Homicidal gassings are said to have happened fast. Ventilation took a while, but still the exposure time, yeah, fumigations could have been half a day or up to a day. But as I said, homicidal gas chambers, underground, cool, warm, moist, and alkaline, they would have accumulated and transformed during the little time they had, way more than the others had in a longer period of time. All things put together, At the end of it, I claim that with all the data I found, both facilities should have had a similar tendency by order of magnitude to form these blue pigments. But the fact is, we find a lot in the homeless, in the fumigation chambers, and nothing in the homeless metal gas chambers. This is the chemical basis. There's more to it, since I had to go a lot into how were these rooms engineered, how were they equipped, and so forth. There come additional arguments that are architectural, engineering in nature, that bolster the chemical conclusion. Something similar that Fred Royster has done in his report too. He had very little access to documentation. I had vast amount of documentation by the time I was doing my research, because a year after Royster had published his massive documentation, publishing blueprints and documents of the camp was issued by a French publishing house, which I could access, Royster could not. Plus later on, in updated editions, I had additional information on a number of issues due to archival research that mainly Colomatania had done over the years. So basically, homicidal gassings, when we look at the forensic situation or chemical, toxicological, engineering, and architectural, can be excluded for the locations that we can still investigate pretty much with certainty.
Now, this research that you conducted, was it first of its kind, or were there other people in Germany or other countries that looked into the matter before you did, or were you the one that broke the ground here?
Now, as I mentioned, Fred Royster was the one who broke the ground. That was 3 years before me in 1988 for the second Zündel trial in Canada. He was asked to go to these places and do the research, and he did so. And the Royster report, by the way, is volume number 16 of our Holocaust Handbook series. You guys can look it up there. It has been updated with footnotes and remarks and an addendum that I wrote, bringing it up to speed. He was the one who broke the ground, and he was working, instructed, and aided by his mentor, Robert Forson. Professor Robert Forson was the one who had the idea that such forensic research needs to be done, and he was actually in the background the one who helped Fred Royster write his report. Fred Royster had never done anything like that. I didn't have the expertise and knowledge, and Forson in the background was helping there. So it's them as a team who broke the ice in 1988. I started my research only in late 1990, and then with all seriousness, having been hired by a law firm in 1991. So no, I was second. Now, I was the one who had the skill set, the time, and the access to resources to put it on firm footing and insert it into a much broader approach to research to the entire topic. But now I was not the trailblazer. I was for Oyster with Robert Forson.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned as well that you face considerable persecution by the German state. What laws did they invoke to justify the use of state repression against you and your publications?
Back when they prosecuted me, they didn't have a specific law outlawing contesting the Holocaust, the mainstream Holocaust narrative. That was actually implemented as a result of Fred Royster's research and the ripple effect it had in Germany. In 1994, this law was launched. Before that, they had a number of laws they used to the same effect, and that was inciting the masses, inciting to the racial hatred, denigrating the commemoration of the dead, and insulting, in that case, insulting the Jews. So these four laws were used against me. The denigrating the commemoration of the dead and insult is just a minor misdemeanor, which carries a maximum term, I don't even know, maybe a year or so. The other two, inciting the masses and inciting to racial hatred, one of them can't remember, one of the entitlement to racial hatred doesn't exist anymore. They law, they got rid of that law because races don't exist, therefore you can't excite to racial hatred. That's the logic of liberals and lefties, and therefore they got rid of that law. But they still have inciting the masses, and that goes with up to 5 years. Now the new law they implemented in 1994 that specifically outlaws Holocaust denial is actually just a paragraph added to the one of inciting the masses. It now specifically says, in I think it's paragraph 3 in that law, that you, if you deny any act of National Socialism that constitutes genocide as defined by international law, you go up to 5 years prison. They used that law for later prosecutions, but not for the initial one for my experience, because back then it didn't exist. And I was found guilty on all four charges, of course, because the logic of the court was, even though I did not mention Jews in my expert report at all, the reader inclined to believe me must inevitably get the impression that Jews, who constitute the main witnesses to this narrative, have lied for ulterior motives. And therefore, this assumption will instill hostile feelings in the inclined reader toward Jews, and therefore can lead to those readers denying the Jews the equal right or any right to live. So in other words, the court argued that by not mentioning Jews at all, I denied them the right to live. And sentenced me to 14 months in prison.
Oh, wow. That is truly absurd.
Yeah.
And in the U.S., here's the thing. There is a difference, in my opinion, in terms of the way authoritarianism and tyranny manifests itself. Because it seems like in Europe, it's a bit more formalized, whereas in the U.S., there's still very strong free speech protections on paper, but you can get harassed in very unconventional ways through, like, the debanking of your payment processors, censorship online, and other forms of harassment campaigns. Have you faced similar harassment campaigns in the United States?
Oh, yeah. All the time. Anything you can think of. My private banking I haven't lost, because I've always separated my business from my private banking, and therefore my private banking has so far been unchallenged. But business banking has been a challenge. I have lost business banking. Years ago, I made the mistake of actually having the same business account and private account with the same bank, and then the business account got closed and my private account too. So I've, ever since I've, my eggs in different baskets. But American Express denied having business with us. People can't pay on our website with American Express. Gateway providers, we are blacklisted with most gateway providers that exist. To tell the listeners what that is, a gateway provider is actually the company that links an exchange of credit card payment information from the payment processing company that you've hired to the bank. So the gateway is the gateway keepers of information flow from wherever the payment is made, online, on your server, or on any provider that you hire, to the bank. There are, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 companies in the United States that do that. So there's a very limited amount, and the majority of them by now have blackmailed us. So it gets narrower and narrower. Payment processing service providers, as they call them, they just program the front end for you for the website and do customer service in case there are problems with payments. They don't connect actually with the bank. That's the gateway provider. So the merchant service providers frequently get, because they are on your website identifiable which company it is, they get put under pressure by the usual lobby groups, and they frequently drop us to go to other ones. There are a few out that we have found that are resilient and do not cave in to Jewish or anti-fascist pressure. The more serious issue is that Amazon, since 2017, systematically refused to carry material that they find politically incorrect or offensive. They started out with Holocaust skeptic material, but they have expanded it to all kinds of material now, mostly conservative right-wing material of various types that are banned from Amazon. Amazon controls 85 to 90% of all new book sales in the United States. They're, technically speaking, a monopoly. It shouldn't be allowed to do them. That, and there's actually, I have a documentary on it where I show, if you go to holocausthandbooks.com to documentaries, I have a documentary that says the day Amazon murdered free speech. I go into the history of Amazon censoring more and more people. And there is an investigator who tries to get publishing companies across the board in the whole country. Publishers fear Amazon. They completely depend on them because 90%, 85 to 90% of every publisher's turnover goes through Amazon. You have to have a good relationship with Amazon. And if you publisher do anything that Amazon dislikes, you are in danger of having your account suspended or shut down. This is immediate bankruptcy for your company. You cannot afford this. So with the abuse that Amazon is doing, caving into pressure from Jewish and leftist organizations, has come to the point that publishing companies don't dare publish anything politically incorrect anymore because they can ruin the business, and they don't dare stand up. In theory, when these publishers would all come together and have an inquiry at a Congress, a hearing in Congress about abuse of monopoly, Amazon would be forced by law to not censor anyone because they're in a position where they have a quasi-monopoly. And by case law, they are not allowed, should not be allowed to turn down anything that is legal. But it's happening because book publishers are afraid they will not agree to a congressional hearing because once they stand up against Amazon the next day for some invented problem with their account or customer complaints, they have their account suspended. And if 90% of your business is gone for a week, you're out of business. So it has come to the point where Amazon actually bullies Ingram Content Group to throw out certain publishing companies. Now, who is Ingram Content Group? The book distribution in the United States is completely 100% monopolized. There's only one company in the United States that gathers all the publications from all the publishers in the country and from abroad, and then gives the information and distributes the book to all the book outlets, internet, as well as brick and mortar shops. Amazon gets their book data from Ingram Content Group. Everyone else does so too, unless you have your own little shop like we do only our books and a few of friendly publishers. But if you want books in print data of the books that are available, automatically fed, they come from Ingram Content Group. Ingram Content Group has 100% total monopoly in book distribution. 85% of their turnover nowadays is through Amazon. If Amazon catches a cold, Ingram is having a pneumonia. Amazon says, take them out. We don't like them. Ingram will do so. Ingram is a monopoly. They are not allowed to shut the door for anyone as long as what this anyone is doing is legal. So if a publisher book that's legal in the United States, Ingram has to take it. There's case law already. They have to take it. We got thrown out by Ingram on the pressure of Amazon in 2019. First 2017, Amazon lost 50% of our turnover back then. Then Ingram throws us out because Amazon pressures us. We lost 90% of our turnover of the 50% that was still left over. In other words, Castle Publishers shortly thereafter went belly up. We've reorganized now. We do real direct marketing, and we do not put our books into international distributions anymore because we don't want them to have the flip switch in their hand to kill our business. So we do only direct marketing, safe, for the encyclopedia. It was finding the encyclopedia on Amazon because it's in Grimm, because it's only one book. While the rest is not in distribution because we don't want to be killed. We could sue any lawyer that actually has looked into our case, sees the real shoestring operation. The loss of business is in the tens of thousands of dollars, maybe 100,000 or so per year, if you're optimistic. And no major law firm will take a case of such peanuts dimension if they have to litigate against a multi-billion dollar corporate. So we couldn't find any legal representation. And if we could, we couldn't even afford it. Because, you know, if this is about hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars, they can work pro bono, they win the case, they get a cut of whatever settlement you get or whatever verdict you get. But if it's about peanuts, they want upfront money and then you can't afford it because you lost just 80% of your business and you don't have the revenue. I'm sure we're not the only one facing that. I know from other companies, Bonds River has faced that in years before, being thrown out by Ingram in various means. It happens all the time. Monopolies do exist in the United States and they can pretty much do what they want. And that is the way censorship is imposed in America. It doesn't go by government penal law as it goes in most European countries, but it goes by economically excluding you from the marketplace. And another one is advertisement. You can't get advertisement into any mainstream media because they just won't let you see what you're doing and you're out, and the major advertisement company will blacklist you, so you can't get any contact with them. And so the story goes on. Fortunately, in the days of social media, you have those channels. If it weren't for the fact that if you do certain things there, eBay throws you out, YouTube throws you out, Vimeo throws you out, and Facebook, you need to be very careful there. They can cancel you. Twitter is relatively free, but there you have to be careful too. If you push it too far, you get banned from all these platforms. YouTube is an almost monopoly. That is very important, has been very important for us up to summer of 2019 for advertising reaching hundreds of thousands of people. And then they threw us out, and that killed again. It was just half a year after Ingram had thrown us out. We were hanging on with doing advertisement through YouTube, and then they cut us out, and there was another hit. So one hit after another, you get cut out of every corner, nook and cranny of society and be reduced to selling out of the trunk of your car, typically speaking.
That seems to be the reality in 2025. Based on your interactions with the broader revisionist community, which is multinational and international in scope, have people found any country or region of the world to be somewhat more receptive and not as hostile towards these ideas in the publication of these ideas?
With all the bad things that are going on in the United States, it's still the best place of all. You should think that Muslim countries in Arabic countries, which is not necessarily the same thing, biggest Muslim country is Indonesia, and some Arabic countries aren't even just Muslim. Be that as it may, these two broad communities, white communities, should have huge communities too, should have an interest in it because they have ongoing problems with Jewish supremacism and imperialism, for which the Holocaust ideology is, of course, the main psychological weapon. But what unfortunately I've seen is that they don't believe Holocaust skepticism has any merits. They see it as a weapon to harass and annoy the Jews, and they think it's probably a lie, and they kind of think, well, Hitler better have killed the 6 million, because if it didn't, that would be bad at this current juncture of political developments in the Middle East with what's going on in Gaza calls for let's rebuild the gas chambers are becoming more and more frequent, and I'm not happy to hear that because that's not a solution. So this is a weird attitude that I've encountered in the Muslim world where they don't want to hear that Hitler didn't kill 6 million because then they are disappointed. Well, I don't do my research for that kind of attitude. But there is a completely different culture, and get anyone there to listen and to take the patience to absorb the material and work on it to get it out in Arabic has been I would say a nightmare, but it's not going anywhere. I've been trying. Maybe it's a good thing because who knows where that ends up blowing up in my face with the consequences that can have. But fact of the matter is, it should, but it does not find any major interest there. And with the rest of the world just being bystanders, not involved in any of it, you can't get any interest in China, in India, in South America. It's Latin America in general, really limited. They have other issues. They're not involved in that. That's a Western world topic. And United States with this First Amendment, no matter all the political pressure that leads to economic suppression and persecution and censorship, it's still the best place to be and the only place where, legally speaking, it's safe to do these things, relatively safe. I mean, I don't have U.S. citizenship, but that makes it a little bit precarious because if you're a green card holder, U.S. government can deport you at any time, not because they're allowed to by law, they cannot, but they do it anyway. Trump has said that. And as I mentioned, I was deported in 2005, even though I was married to a U.S. citizen, had no criminal record, according to U.S. standards, and was eligible for a green card, had that actually documented. I can't just get the green card. It was only a formal step. They deported me anyway. Trump has right now, just a few weeks ago, months ago, deported a green card holder married to a U.S. citizen because he had critical views on what's going on in Gaza. And I'm in a similar boat. So I was profoundly scared of when Trump started deporting immigrants, even legal immigrants. Deporting illegal immigrants is one thing. If you come into the country, not legally, but by violating the law or by taking advantage of loopholes and whatever, then there's nothing to argue against. Enforcing the law, if the law says it shouldn't be here and we should be able to deport them and just enforce the law. Yeah, law is there to be enforced. But if you come here illegally and then still get the shitty treatment, then that's not right. So for U.S. citizens, the United States is safe. It's not economically safe. If you touch that third rail, you have your career destroyed. You have your social fabric torn to pieces because most people don't want to have anything to do with you. You find out who's really a friend, who isn't, who judges you for the person who you are rather than for what the general public thinks you are or accepts your friend's socialism. From that point of view, it is a cleansing storm of your social network, but it hurts either way. And I'm not a member of anything because I can't. People find out my background. I'm a member of a parish. They threw me out of the parish. You can read as much as you want in the New Testament and what Jesus says about how the church should treat social pariahs. In his times, there were the tax collectors, the whores, the Roman soldiers, and whatever. Today, it's the Holocaust skeptics and whatever else you can come up with. But social pressure and brainwashing and taboo does things to people. But still, all things said, I have looked for other places. I'm constantly looking into it. There are always small countries like the Caribbean. There are a lot of islands that don't give rat's ass. They're not invested in it. You could live there happily and do whatever you please. The problem is if a country like Germany, which has a lot of diplomatic and financial clout. Demands of a banana republic in, say, Granada or whatever, to deport a guy they want deported, even if it's against the law of Granada, you get deported. Germany cannot order the United States to deport someone. It's not going to fly. I have actually physical proof because I have access to my files of ongoing criminal investigation in Germany for the things I keep publishing. And they clearly said again and again, don't waste money and time asking the United States for extradition because it's not going to happen. But if you are in a banana republic that in and of itself is not interested in what you say about the Auschwitz gas chambers, they will instantly cave in to German or European diplomatic or financial pressure and blackmailing. So that's the nice thing about America. That blackmailing doesn't work here.
Where do you see the future of World War II and Holocaust revisionism going? Are you optimistic about it?
Robert Frost once coined the memorable expression that he's very optimistic when it comes to Holocaust revisionism and very pessimistic when it comes to Holocaust revisionists. If you look at the trajectory we've taken, when he said that, we had just started our Holocaust handbook series, and now we're up to 53, and we've blown up mainstream research big time with the encyclopedia, which is now out in German, Spanish, and English, and we're preparing a French, Portuguese, Swedish, Russian, Polish, Italian, Greek, and two-dimensional Swedish edition. They're all coming out at some point or another. You will not find an Holocaust encyclopedia of the mainstream that has ever been published in other languages. Well, that's not true. The Yad Vashem one has been published into German. But that's as far as it goes. And we are constantly, with a new print on demand, doing new editions, and we're expanding in the internet sphere. We have holocaustacademy.com, we have holocaustencyclopedia.com, we have holocausthandbooks.com. They get more and more attention. It can't be erased. It can't be deleted. They're now, the encyclopedia, available in more and more languages. This thing is spreading throughout the world like a cancer, and it will eventually bring down the old world order. One way or another, there will come a paradigm shift. I don't know when, I don't know how it's going to happen, I don't know where the shift goes to, and I don't even know whether I will like the direction it's going to be, but it will happen. When it will happen, I don't know. There's no way of predicting these things. Sometimes, you know, there were a few people who predicted the collapse of the Soviet Union because the economic data was just there if you paid attention, but nobody was paying attention, or very few were paying attention. And then it happened, and some said, told you so. I don't think we have these clear signs of the collapse of the post-World War II world order quite yet, but to some degree, it may be with China gearing up. They have massive internal problems with demographic collapse and now they have economic collapse, not just because of the trade war, but because everyone else diversifying, getting out of China. They would have come one way or another. China is trying to solve their internal problems by uniting the population, by having exterior conflict, maybe even war. That is a strategy, has been the strategy of many a dictatorship to rally support of a disgruntled population behind some cause. That conflict, if it does come, can go sideways for humanity big time and will lead to some paradigm shift. Catastrophic. I don't want to have it. I don't know where it ends up, if it's better for revisionism after that. There are so many things that can happen. There's no way of telling. But something is coming, I'm sure. It may take a decade, it may take a lifetime, it may take more, I don't know.
The point you mentioned about revisionists, that you're not so optimistic about revisionists, what do you mean by that?
Well, persecution is going to step up. It has always stepped up and increased, and I don't see the future of revisionists when it comes to their safety, to their comfort. I'm not too optimistic about that. As I said, it requires a paradigm shift. And the old system latching on to what they think will preserve its longevity or extend it and the Holocaust narrative is one of their main psychological tool in their psychological armory, and ramping up propaganda and ramping up suppression of dissent is just something that any dictatorship will do. And I'm clearly talking about dictatorship, not in the United States. Dictatorship is a country that dictates with penal law, with police, with rifles pointing at heads, how you can write or talk about history is a dictatorship. And they're all democracies, and there's no contradiction between dictatorship and democracy, because democracy is where two wolves and a lamb decide what's for dinner. That's the definition of democracy. The two wolves dictate to the lamb that you will be dinner. It's a democratic dictatorship. No contradiction. It goes hand in hand. If democracy is not guardrailed in by strict adherence to civil rights, to due process, to the division of powers, and so forth, it is nothing more but a lynch mob. And that's what we see when it comes to these contentious issues of World War II. Those governments, those societies in Europe, they are democracies, they are, but when it comes to this topic, but a lynch mob against dissidents. And that's not a good future prospect for us revisionists. Until that goes away, I think it's going to get worse.
That's the unfortunate reality of like the liberal international order / Judeo-American order that is effectively an oligarchical tyranny for the benefit of organized Jewry. But we have to struggle one way or the other. But regardless, I was thoroughly enthralled by this conversation, Germar, and I appreciate your time and attention for this. And before you leave, make sure to take this opportunity to promote your works.
Personally, if you want to go read about me and my work and how to support me and the struggle I've been through, my own website is germarrudolf.com. Now, Germar is G-R-M-A-R, Rudolf, like the red nosed reindeer, but it has an F at the end, not a P-H, so it's R-U-D-O-L-F.com. You can find there also a link in the menu that says signed copies, signed books. The books I've written myself, currently I think I'm up to 19. They can all be bought there as a signed and dedicated copy. So if you want to support me or want to get something in return, a single one of these, or any combination of them, of these 19 books that I've written over the past 35 years, you can order there. They're marked up at roughly twice the price than the normal price. On the order website of each of these books, you find also links to where you can buy the books at the normal rate, not marked up, but they will not be signed by me, evidently, because they come directly from the printer. That is my private website, germarrudolf.com. I already mentioned the massive amount of research that I've put in and published over the last 35 years, majority of which not by me. I've published it, but did not do the actual footwork. That was mainly Italian historian Carlo Martagno. You can find that free of charge at holocausthandbooks.com. All the PDFs are up there, except for one book we have a contract with that we cannot hang out completely, but the rest is. Also, documentaries there if you want to get a deep dive into a number of these issues with a movie documentary. All the books there have links, the pages for the books have links where you can buy them. The place to buy all these books, not signed by me, is actually armreg.co.uk. That is arm, like your limb, ARM, reg, reg.co.uk. So it's a British company based in London. That's the reorganized publishing company that went belly up. As I mentioned, Castle Publishers is what I started out with. And because of all the economic restrictions, got into financial trouble. And then we had some internal fight and the whole thing went belly up late 23, we organized is armreg.co.uk, armreg.co.uk. There you can get all the books that we have put out. I mentioned the holocaustencyclopedia.com to make all this information accessible, free of charge. You can also, there in the bookstore, buy the English, German, or Spanish copy, hard copy, PDF copy, or ebook version of the book, one with just text, the other one with audio. There's also a free download with ads in it for guys, people who want to have it on their computer or on their smartphone, so you can carry it with you at all times. It can be freely distributed and copied and shared. And ultimately, I mentioned the HolocaustAcademy.com. That's still fledgling. It's just an interesting point of reference for people to see what we're up to. And we will actually start giving classes privately. We do this always privately, it's not publicly, because we can't be held or don't want to be responsible for people getting public exposure for taking classes. That is like touching a third rail, could have severe consequences. So it's all behind the scenes, it's all private and discreet. But anyone can take those classes, you know, online. And in special cases, we can even travel if there's enough of an audience or financial incentives and give actual lectures and seminars. A new project that we're very proud of. And the last one is CODO.com. That's the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, an organization that was kind of created in the late 1980s. It's, I think, 89 it was kind of created, and is trying to lobby for free speech where it is most threatened, because that's the ultimate taboo topic of the Western world, where the consequences of breaching that taboo are most severe. And we the most in active part of it is what we publish there in the Inconvenient History periodical. As I mentioned, there's some parallels between what we do on Inconvenient History and the Barnes Review when it comes to sharing articles. So that is pretty much covering it. The website there for CODO is CODOH.com, Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. I think I covered all the bases with that.
Yes, you sure did. And also, I would like to remind our audience that we at the Barnes Review also have the Rudolph Report by Germar and his colleague Wolfgang Lambrecht. And we have that on our website where you can purchase your copy there. And
not just that, most of the books that we have is actually carried by the Barnes Review too. You guys do also do the Holocaust Encyclopedia. And the new books that I released, I think at least the Holocaust, the Root of the Story. No, the Nazi Gas Chambers, the Root of the Stories. I think you took that out too. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, yes, most of the books that Armreg carries are also available from the Barnes Review.
Yes, if you go to our website and search Germar Rudolph, you will find a wealth of information and content that you could purchase and to support his work and the dissemination of the inquiries about the Holocaust. So you can get the real history there. And I'd like to thank you again, Rudolph, for coming on to the show, and also to the audience for their attention. And for the Barnes Review History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.